I'll open a joint meeting of the Interim House Judiciary Committee and Senate Judiciary Committee for Wednesday, January 16, 2008. Senator Brzozinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'm going to do is open, not only we are into our meeting now, but I'm going to go ahead and open a work session for the purpose of bill introduction on the Senate side. And I need to make a couple of comments. We have three different bills, LCs, that we will be introducing from the Senate Judiciary. Two of them will not be introduced until Friday at this point because we unfortunately did not get those onto our schedule, our agenda. So if those individuals that may be following what is known as LC 47, LC 48, they will be introduced through the procedure that's required by the Senate on Friday. That will be done by teleconferencing calls for many of the members since they will be in different locations than they are today. So with that, I will take a motion regarding LC 49. Yes, Senator Beyer.
I move the introduction of Legislative Concept 49 of the Judiciary Committee bill.
Thank you. Senator Beyer has moved for LC 49, Legislative Concept 49, to move forward.
She didn't hear us.
That will just be an introduction of the bill. Let's make certain everyone understands this is for all of us, and this is really for those who are listening at some point on this recording. This is a process that the Senate, as well as the House, uses to actually get bills into the hopper. This does not mean when members will be voting, hopefully in support of moving LC 49 into the process, that they will in fact be supporting the bill when it comes out. This is just a courtesy of moving the process forward. And so please don't assume that just because someone may be voting in the affirmative on any of these LCs that may be before us, that they are going to actually be in support of the measure when it comes up through the process of the supplemental session. So with that, I'll ask if there's any objection to the introduction of LC 49 by the senators. Not seeing or hearing any, the motion passes, and we'll show that Senator Burdick is excused. My understanding is she's on her way, but because of the weather, she's running a little behind. So with that, I'll close the work session on the Senate work session this time, and we'll go back to our informational meeting, Mr. Chair.
I'll open an informational meeting with the first item of which is an update on the state's response to the meth epidemic, and we are honored to have Rob Bovet and Lieutenant Mike Dingeman here to present to us. Gentlemen.
Good morning, Chair McPherson, Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee. Thank you for having us here. My name is Rob Bovet, legal counsel for the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association. With me here this morning is Mike Dingeman for the Oregon State Police. He is the commander of our drug enforcement section. Also here today, in case you have questions, because we're going to be covering a lot of ground really quickly, we also have Anna Peterson, who's the chair of the Governor's Meth Task Force, Kayleen Dethridge, who's the chair of the Prevention Subcommittee of that task force, Joe O'Leary from the Governor's Office, who serves on that task force as well, Mike Stafford, who serves as staff of the task force. What I thought we'd do here for you this morning in real brief fashion is provide, and I guess a real quick comment before I get started, we provided you essentially a little notebook here. My disclaimer is most of this stuff is reference material. If you're a glutton for punishment, please feel free to read it. Primarily why we've provided it to you is two reasons. One is a lot of people like to follow along with PowerPoints in the book, and tab one is basically a printout of the PowerPoint you're going to be seeing in case you want to take notes. Tab two, which we just stuffed, is the Governor's Meth Task Force report that literally got printed, 5 minutes ago? Yeah, 5 minutes ago, so it's fresh and hot off the press. But here this morning in the PowerPoint, I thought I would just briefly update you on the progress we've made. I think it's okay to celebrate some of our successes, maybe reflect on some of our failures, and then kind of chart the course for the next steps we need to be looking at. So we'll talk about some of the progress in terms of meth labs, in terms of meth purity, meth price, recent trends in property crime. We'll talk briefly about some of the most recent trends we've seen here throughout the Pacific Northwest in terms of meth and ecstasy, prescription drugs, and underage drinking. And then we'll talk very briefly about the work ahead and what we're looking to do here over the next 2 years. Let's talk about some of the progress first, and I'll start with meth labs, which is probably the most widely reported, and we took some strong action back in 2004, 2005, and again in 2007. And just as a quick reminder of why we talk about meth labs and how we were able to do what we did, the key ingredient necessary to make the powerful form of methamphetamine on our street requires that you have the base ingredient, ephedrine or pseudoephedrine. This is where ephedrine and pseudoephedrine come from in nature. Small amounts of ephedrine and trace amounts of pseudoephedrine come from the ephedra sinica plant, which is the Chinese herb Ma Wang. You really can't get enough pseudoephedrine or ephedrine out of the plant to really make any substantial amount of methamphetamine. So as a practical matter, the world supply, the bulk of the world supply of pseudoephedrine comes from 9 large factories or in 3 countries, and we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to the international picture and some of the latest trends there. This is why, and you don't have to be a total science geek like myself and enjoy organic chemistry to get the idea of what's happening here. This is the pseudoephedrine and methamphetamine molecules all charted out for you with all the atomic structure laid out. On the left is pseudoephedrine, on the right is methamphetamine. So the one on the left decongests your nose, the one on the right gets you high like nothing else. The only difference between those two molecules is that one red oxygen atom. That's why it is the key ingredient necessary to make meth. So when we talk about a meth lab, and this is true whether we're talking about mom and pop cooking on the kitchen stove all the way up to your super labs cooking out 100, 200 pounds at a time, it's the basic same process here. There's 2 variations and 1,000 variations of each. You start with pseudoephedrine or ephedrine, move the hydroxyl group, add back hydrogen, and you got meth. Now, that to do that in real life is insanity, of course. It's caustic, catches fire, explodes, poisons everything, but it's really simple from an organic chemistry perspective. This is a slide that we've used for, well, quite a number of sessions now, and I think it's important to say it again because often people forget why we went after pseudoephedrine here in the state of Oregon and now 12 other states, actually nationwide here as of September 30th of last year. And this is the truth of the matter, and let's reflect on it again. Even when we were taking down 40 meth labs a month like clockwork in the state of Oregon, most of the meth on our street didn't come from those meth labs. It came from the super labs south of the border. Even at its height, the bulk of the meth came from south of the border. When we first enacted our pseudoephedrine control regulations, only about 20% of the meth on our street came from our local toxic meth labs. So the question became, for many folks, why are you going after pseudoephedrine here? Why aren't you going after international? Well, we were going after international, but the reason we went after pseudoephedrine here was not to get rid of meth. It was to get rid of meth labs. Those are the things that were catching fire, exploding, poisoning our environment, poisoning our kids, having cops go from meth lab to meth lab to meth lab and home health nurses. Getting rid of that public health safety in and of itself was what we were going after. This take catches you up to when I last spoke with you about this a little over a year ago when you had me provide you an update. These are the lessons we had learned nationwide, not just from Oregon, but from about 12 different states. We learned from Hard Knocks that if you simply and merely limited the quantity you could purchase of pseudoephedrine.
Senator Meyer, could I ask for a clarification on one point on your last slide? Even though the meth volume versus the that side, you know, the 80-20 ratio.
Mm-hmm.
I recall in 05 when we were going through this process that it was, talk about the time allocation element of how much time it was taking law enforcement, DHS, everything else in the meth lab side of it. Rather than just, I recognize it was 20% of the volume. I mean, at that time we thought it was about 30% of the volume.
35 is the height of it.
Okay. But I recall that it was the vast majority of the time of law enforcement and human resources and everything else was going into the meth lab side, not into the meth supply side.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Bayer, you recall exactly correctly. Our narcotics teams were, it was tremendous. They were just literally going from meth lab to meth lab to meth lab. They weren't able to spend any time on proactive investigations doing what they really traditionally had been doing, which is taking down organizations. They were just getting called out over and over and over again to take down meth labs. And in my little county of Lincoln County, we got a small narcotics team. At the height of this, we took down 26 meth labs in a year. These guys are just spending, that's all they were doing, just taking down meth labs. and it was catastrophic and it was devastating. So that's why we went after it. Even though it was only 20% of the supply of the meth, it was consuming nearly all the time.
Okay, so at the following, is the reverse now true that the meth lab department, I assume we're going to see what that number is now,
yes.
But is the law enforcement able to concentrate now on what is the big ticket item, the amount of meth?
Yes, indeed, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute.
Let me just put one other thing on the record, if I could. And my understanding is the other reason we went after the mom and pop meth labs, those were within our border, within the state of Oregon, as the predominantly the super labs were not within our border, and we didn't really have, as a state, a lot of control. That's where, with all your great work that you've done in getting other states as well as the on the national front to start addressing that for on a national and an international level.
Yeah, we had, Mr. Chair, we had, I think, one or two meth super labs a year at its height, and we weren't really, California was for a while a large source of the super labs, but really now almost all of them are in Mexico. So back to lessons we learned, we learned here in Oregon, and we learned in a bunch of other states, that if you moved things behind the counter, if you moved the ephedrine and the pseudoephedrine behind the counter, you got a 40 to 70% reduction, depending on what state you're in, where you wound up. We were up close to about a 60% reduction overall when we tried this. I call it Schedule 5 light, and we'll talk about what the difference is here in a moment. And that's good. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. We got some really dramatically good results. Getting rid of half of your meth labs in the state of Oregon and in a bunch of other states is phenomenal. But as Senator Burdick reminded me, and many of you on the Meth Caucus reminded me, 50% is still a failing grade. What is your tolerance level for local toxic meth labs? And we decided here in Oregon that it's zero. We took the next step, so did Oklahoma, now so has 12 other states, by going to full Schedule 5, which requires the pseudoephedrine be placed behind the pharmacy counter with a picture ID and logging for each sale. That has resulted, after now numerous years of data, in a 70 to 90% reduction, depending again on what state you're in and various variables and factors, which is also phenomenal. It's a tremendous impact. It's a tremendous relief to law enforcement, to drug-endangered children, to DHS, home health nurses, on and on and on and on. But it's still not getting rid of the rest of the meth labs. We wound up here in Oregon at 79% overall reduction based on Schedule 5, which, again, is good. But what about the remaining 20%? That was the question that you asked us in 2005. You said, okay, fine, this is all good, but how do we get rid of the rest of them? And we, of course, had to go back to figure out where the meth cooks were getting their pseudoephedrine from. And it turned out then that it was from the places we expected, group smurfing primarily, and some interstate smurfing. Now, let me explain smurfing for those of you in the audience that aren't familiar with that term. I think all of you on in the committee are. Smurfing is where you basically have a home meth cook that's an addict, and he gathers up or she gathers up six or seven or eight other meth addicts, and they just go from pharmacy to pharmacy to pharmacy, buying enough pseudoephedrine to give back to the meth cook. The meth cook cooks it up, and everybody gets their meth. And those are all smurfs, and so you got a cook and a bunch of smurfs, based on those little blue characters. The fix that we came up with to address interstate smurfing, to end people going across to Washington or across to Oregon or up to Idaho or California, was to nationalize our success in Oregon and Oklahoma, take it across the nation. So we drafted up a bill, introduced it in Congress, called the Combat Meth Act. It would have nationalized the Oregon-Oklahoma rule. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get it passed as we originally drafted it. The industry watered it down to some degree, converted it into what is now the Combat Meth Epidemic Act. It went nationwide on September 30th of 2006. It is Schedule 5 light. So across the nation on September 30th of 2006, all the pseudoephedrine got pulled behind the counter, but it's still in the convenience stores, unfortunately. And we recognized early on, based on studies conducted in a number of states, including Oregon and in Oklahoma, and I'll just show you the graph there. For example, on the far left is a graph showing a convenience store in Oklahoma. The yellow bar represents sales of Coca-Cola products. The red bar represents sales of pseudoephedrine products out of that convenience store. So we were bleeding fairly heavily out of convenience stores across the nation. We recognized that it wasn't necessarily the fault of the convenience stores. There are places designed to deal with controlled substances, and they're called pharmacies. They're not called convenience stores. group sniffing was the bigger issue for us, and that's where, as I described, you get a local crook, you have a bunch of addicts, and you just go from store to store to store to store to store. There were a couple of ideas circulated around the nation about how to address group smurfing. How do we shut down the smurfers? A number of states decided they would look at electronic monitoring. I'll describe what that involves and why that has not progressed thus far. Here in Oregon, we looked at Schedule 3, going back to the way pseudoephedrine was prior to 1976, making it a prescription drug. And four of you actually proved the point. The Meth Caucus from 2005 became effectively my smurfers. I brought a meth lab to the Capitol, and we held a press conference, and over the course of 20 minutes, as I recall, the four of you purchased enough pseudoephedrine for me to cook about 200 hits of meth for you. And that's with full Schedule 5. So you proved effectively how group smurfing occurs in reality in the state of Oregon. We passed the bill. Everybody was looking at Oregon for a while, and the results are, to be quite honest, more dramatic than we expected. And we'll talk about some of the other side results as well. The federal government fairly quickly issued a report recognizing that Oregon had not only taken the strongest action to control pseudoephedrine in the nation, but Oregon got the best results. We got the deepest reductions in the nation. Since that time, it's even more dramatic. We've had a near elimination of smurfing and a near elimination of local toxic meth labs. This is our current data as of the end of the year. And a couple of notes that make it even more dramatic. This data is assembled basically on the national standard so we can compare state to state, apples to apples, and we don't get all messed up. What this data basically will show you is that prior to controlling pseudoephedrine, as I mentioned before, our narcotics folks were taking down about 40 meth labs, and we're reporting 40 meth lab incidents a month, kind of like clockwork, year in, year out. So 440, 450, you see the numbers there. As we went through our series of progressively stronger controls, you can see what happened to the numbers. We wound up at the end with 18 in 2007 for the entire year. And I should explain, what those numbers also represent is a conglomeration of three different categories of meth labs. Let's back up into those black numbers. When we were talking about 40 a month, really there are three categories of meth labs there. There's full meth labs. There's also dump sites, where the police or someone discover a dump site on the forest. There's also remnants, so glassware. People are assembling things to do a meth lab maybe in the future, or remnants from the past. On average, what that represented when we were in those black months, I'll call them, about 25 out of those 40 each month were full meth labs. The other 15 were either dump sites or remnants. The 18 you see here for 2007, the even more dramatic thing about this reduction was 16 of those were dump sites or remnants. We only had two full meth lab incidents in the entire state of Oregon for the 2007 year. It's phenomenal, and everybody has recognized around the nation how phenomenal it has become. If you model things based on the federal model, which counts all the dump sites and everything, we still have a 95% overall reduction in the incidence of meth labs in the state of Oregon. Nobody else can come anything close to claiming our reductions, but if you model it based on full meth labs, you get closer to a 99% reduction, what I call a near elimination. But then again, of course, there's always Colbert. I don't watch TV much. In fact, I don't watch it at all, frankly. But my wife does, and she watches this guy. And about 6 months ago, she screams at me from the other room. She says, "Get in here, Rob. Get in here. You got to see this. This guy is like, he's making fun of you." I said, "Well, what do you mean he's making fun of me?" And so I go in there. She says, "He's making fun of that law you worked on there, and that you worked all that, blah, blah, blah." And so I got to show this to you because it's just so good.
I think you might be right. Welcome to the show. I hope you had a good weekend. It was rough for me. I don't know if any of you have caught this cold going around, but I have it, and it is hell. If I ever find out who gave it to me, they're going to wish. Maybe I'll just buy them some soup. Anyway, I took a whole box of cold medicine on Friday, and nothing. Bupkis. Might as well have been eating Skittles. Problem is, see, the drug companies are starting to take out the decongestant, the pseudoephedrine, from these pills, because people use the pseudoephedrine to make crystal meth. Evidently, they're replacing the pseudoephedrine with something called Jack's Squatacil, because that's what... But I use the old noodle. I went and found this guy in my neighborhood. called Spider, and he lives in a Ford Taurus behind the Benjamin Moore paint dealer. He sold me some Jenny Crank. Then I took it home, soaked it in some red phosphorus and iodine, and reverse-engineered the high-speed chicken feed into some good old-fashioned Sudafed, which I then ground up and snorted. And and then I cleaned my kitchen for 72 hours.
So there's always a different take on life.
In the meantime, we started to spread the word. Actually, people started to knock on our doors and say, hey, what's going on in Oregon? We've seen your numbers. This is phenomenal. What the heck did you do? So we started presenting both at national and international meth control conferences, hoping to get the attention of our fellow states and get them to take action. We've had a lot of interest here recently, but even more profoundly, we've had interest in Mexico, which just moved to prescription only for all pseudoephedrine down in Mexico. Now, it means something slightly different down there in terms of what prescription only is, because there's a pharmacia on every street corner, so it's slightly different down there. We presented last year, by the way, Mexico is slated to ban pseudoephedrine in 2009, which was something we discussed in 2005, which effectively is Schedule 1. We presented again last year. Great Britain, who was just beginning to experience a meth epidemic, decided to go to prescription only as well. And they're just beginning. Now, I think they only had 5 meth labs in the entire nation last year, but they looked around the world, basically, and said, what is working and what is not working in terms of controlling the supply of meth and in terms of controlling these meth labs? And if you didn't know, and I think I've mentioned this to you before, the United Nations declared meth to be the world's number one drug problem, and they did it because the meth epidemic is not unique to Oregon or our nation. There are raging meth epidemics in East Asia, Southeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, most recently East Europe. It's spreading across Great Britain, Western Canada, Mexico. It's a worldwide epidemic. So we're not in this alone, in other words. Back in the U.S., of course, folks started to look again at electronic monitoring is an alternative to the Oregon solution to getting rid of smurfing. And the idea is this. You take all this collected data from all these logs, you put them into some centralized database, and then you try to figure out how to cull out of that people who might be smurfing. And you give that to law enforcement somehow, and you get them to figure out how to go after these folks. It creates all kinds of issues, not the least of which is very complicated because the states don't operate all the same types of programs. How do we blend all this stuff? It's also based on the premise that smurfers will be using their same identity at each store. And we kind of know a little bit about identity theft and meth addicts and smurfers. It's also incredibly burdensome. This is what I call the pharmacist's worst nightmare in terms of compiling this information off of all these logs, entering all this data for what is essentially non-prescription medicine. Incredibly expensive. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars to implement this type of solution. And based on the preliminary data, we're not even sure it's going to work. So recently, the federal government decided to do what the federal government does best. They set up a couple of committees and task forces to figure out what the heck to do about smurfing, because there's a lot of states out there that have gone the full Schedule 5 and they still only have a 50-60% reduction in meth labs. They're still going from lab to lab to lab in a lot of these states like Tennessee and Missouri and Oklahoma, in fact. So they formed a couple of work groups. National Alliance for Model State Drug Laws was basically tasked with figuring out what works, what doesn't, how can we do this, you know, monitoring program, this electronic monitoring. And the pharmacists were asked to basically come up with a standard for implementing this nationwide. I was asked to participate on both, which I did, mostly just to protect what we had done here in Oregon. The pharmacist came up with this 38 pages of what I call administrative misery for your local pharmacist in terms of trying to implement this. But it would be nationwide, it would be standardized. It would cost a lot of money to implement. The estimates are literally into the hundreds of millions of dollars. Interestingly enough, the National Alliance for Model State Drug Laws, and I did not write this report, actually I only was on the committee, I didn't have anything to do with the authoring of this report. And this is the bottom line conclusion, and I have provided you the full report, and it's only 3 pages long in your notebook. But the bottom line is they tacked on this little section at the end of the report saying, okay, all these problems, here's how we might be able to get around them, and then, oh, by the way, there's Oregon. And the Oregon alternative offers an effective approach. If broadly adopted, there would be no reason to develop state or national tracking systems, resulting in substantial ongoing savings, literally in the millions of dollars. So let's talk about our predictions. What we predicted in the summer of 2005, what's come true, and interestingly enough, what has not come true. We predicted a further reduction in smurfing, which I've just shown you we got. We went from 79% reduction to, depending on the way you count them, 95 or 99% reduction. We predicted the Mexican drug cartels would fill the gap immediately. So when we took that 20% of meth off the street, they would immediately fill the void. And we also predicted the property crimes would increase. And our logic was that once you eliminate the ability of local meth cooks and smurfers to locally cook up their own meth, they're going to have to continue to feed their addiction somehow. And our idea was, well, they're going to have to commit more property crimes to do so. So we predicted meth labs would go down, property crimes would go up as a result of what we did in 2005. As it turns out, of course, we did essentially nearly eliminate meth labs from the state of Oregon. And yes, indeed, the drug cartels immediately filled that gap in supply, that relatively small gap in supply. But interestingly enough, property crimes did not go up in the state of Oregon. And I will not make any claims as to why and how, but the bottom line is this. If you take the 12 states that took the strongest action to control pseudoephedrine in 2004, 2005, and early 2006, the property crime rates in those states declined at nearly twice the rate of the rest of the nation. Even more phenomenally, the property crime rates in the state of Oregon have declined at the greatest rate in the nation. So we got exactly the opposite result that was counterintuitive. We have some kind of wild theories as to why that may have occurred. But our prediction that property crime rates would go up as a result of meth labs being taken away from Oregon was actually 180 degrees the opposite. Let me switch gears real quickly to the international picture, what's happened here recently. As you all recall, the Sunday, or the Oregonian did quite an extensive series on the supply of pseudoephedrine feeding the super labs. And the reality is, back then, and is still is today, that the bulk of the pseudoephedrine in the world comes from 9 factories in 3 countries, 5 in India, 3 in China, and 1 in Germany. And we asked Congress to do something relatively simple, and they did. And the United Nations did the same thing, which is two things. One, if the key ingredient necessary to make meth is coming from 9 factories, why can't we track it to make sure it doesn't get into the bad guy's hands? And why can't we set quotas to make sure that countries don't import obscene amounts of pseudoephedrine? And Congress enacted all that without hesitation, essentially, and the United Nations did the same. They asked all nations to do exactly those two things. I already mentioned the worldwide epidemic and the United Nations declaring meth to be the world's number one drug problem and calling on all countries to track pseudoephedrine, to monitor it, to make sure it didn't get to the bad guys, and to set quotas for countries. This is what's happened, and this is where I left it with you about 12, 13 months ago. This was the report out of the Oregonian, which was confirmed by the DEA, watching the importation of pseudoephedrine into North America. And you can see the bottom literally dropped out, not just in the U.S. And the reason the U.S. supply or importation of pseudoephedrine dropped off is we changed the market. We changed the market from pseudoephedrine to phenylephrine and other decongestants, and people are basically buying alternatives. So that's how it changed in the U.S. Mexico affirmatively imposed quotas. In the middle of 2005, they imposed import quotas on pseudoephedrine, bringing themselves down to 134 metric tons in 2005 and closing out 2006 at 76 metric tons. Now, interestingly enough, the Oregonian had projected that the legitimate need at that time for pseudoephedrine in Mexico was about 70 metric tons. I think it's substantially less than that, but irregardless, you can see a dramatic drop-off of pseudoephedrine going into Mexico. This was the positive result shared with you about 13, 14 months ago. Purity, for the first time in a decade, across our nation, went down dramatically. The price of meth, for the first time in nearly a decade, across our nation, went up. These are good numbers based on good policy. An immediate thing started to happen, and in part as a result of meth and the meth trade and the pseudoephedrine trade, in part as a result of the overall drug trade. And the thing that happened fairly dramatically was the level of violence in Mexico among and between the drug cartels, and it continues fairly unabated to today. The level of violence is quite literally insane in terms of the types of violence and the amount of violence. We were very concerned a year and a half, 2 years ago, that the Mexican government would back off. They would back off of their quotas or allow it to kind of happen, and really back off is stepping on the drug cartels. And thankfully, somewhat to our surprise, they did exactly the opposite. They stepped down even harder on the drug cartels and are continuing to do so today. And I do have to give President Calderon and the Attorney General of Mexico a lot of credit. And you don't need the translation from his speeches. When you hear him talk, he is passionate about dealing with the drug epidemic and in particular methamphetamine on a worldwide basis. Interestingly enough, however, since I spoke with you last, the purity of meth went back up and the price went back down. So there was a little bubble that followed this, and I'll show it to you in a minute. We predicted, and this prediction came true, that, heck, they would just make it on pseudoephedrine. Why not? In Mexico, just make it on pseudoephedrine. There are, of course, two key precursors to ephedrine or pseudoephedrine, acetyl-pseudoephedrine acetate or phenylacetylcarbinol, known as LPAC and APSI. Well, that's exactly what they did. A creative gentleman down in Mexico and his company basically imported huge amounts of the precursor to pseudoephedrine, acetyl-pseudoephedrine, and started manufacturing their own pseudoephedrine and giving it illicitly to the drug cartels to make meth. That was quickly caught by the DEA in Mexico and identified, and by the Mexican government, who closed him down and executed search warrants. And just to give you an idea of how much money we're talking about in this business, when they did the search warrant on his home, his personal home in Mexico City, they pulled $206 million in U.S. currency out of the walls of his house. And that there it is stacked up there, just to give you an idea of how much money we're talking about. He has been arrested and been indicted in both the United States and in Mexico. And there is the bubble. And I call it the Zen Lee bubble. So when it first went down, you can see the purity levels of meth on the streets of our nation. And then you see that bubble, it going back up, because for a short, brief period of time, they started manufacturing their own pseudoephedrine. Since that time, it's back down again. And the inverse relationship is also true. So you see the opposite. It's an upside-down bubble there, the Zen Lee bubble. The price was going up, and all of a sudden went down again because they weren't having to cut it, and it went back up again. And right now, you can see where it's at. So let's talk about some of the most recent trends that we're seeing, and I'll try to focus in here narrowly on Oregon so we can get to talking about maybe briefly what we'd like to see happen over the next couple of years. Meth, of course, let's talk about meth first. There's as much meth on our streets today as there ever has been. It's just less pure, and it's a little more costly. We have to keep monitoring the control of meth. Meth is one of the very few drugs in the world that we can actually control the supply of. We've tried in vain to control the supply of many drugs, but meth and quaaludes and synthetic drugs we can control the supply of because you have to have key ingredients. We're also seeing, unfortunately, a recent trend here in the Pacific Northwest where meth and methylene dioxymethamphetamine, which is ecstasy, are being combined into ecstasy or X tablets and showing up at rave parties and youth parties and being used by youth. We're not exactly sure how or why, although we have our suspicions, but this is an unfortunate trend because not that ecstasy is a good drug. There's all kinds of problems with ecstasy, but seeing meth and ecstasy blended together and having our youth take things thinking it's ecstasy and actually it's meth and ecstasy is problematic, and I project this may be a trend that continues before we get a handle on it. Prescription drug abuse continues to be a pretty massive problem in the state of Oregon, and our trend data is not good, and I'll show you the trend data in a moment. Oregon right now ranks 8th per capita in the nation for prescription drug abuse, and 4th in the nation for prescription drug abuse for our youth. And I'll just graph that out for you by map. If you're a red state in this map, you've got currently a very significant prescription drug abuse problem. If you are red in this map, you are going to continue to have a significant prescription drug abuse problem. This is the youth. So if you're red in both, in which we are, you not only have a problem, but you continue to have a problem.
Rob, on that last slide that you showed us, that one there, does that one reflect the red states as to which ones actually took steps to limit the precursor. I'm see Oklahoma there, us. So I know those are two states that were kind of on the front end of trying to deal with this. I'm just wondering if...
This one doesn't really show that. This is just about prescription drug abuse, so it's doctor shopping.
I'm wondering if it's shifted, though. If we've now shut down the meth in our own states, if we're now seeing that people are now shifting to prescription abuse or medicine.
And Mr. Chair, I think you could be seeing some of that. I think what we've seen anecdotally is a shift to other drugs of abuse like heroin and cocaine. And I think these maps are based on 2004. As you see, 2004 and 2005 NSDOT data before we really did have any impact on the supply and purity of meth. So I suspect that while what you suspect may have some truth to it, this data won't support that, at least not yet.
Okay.
What I will tell you is...
Excuse me, I have a question. I wanted you to flip back. I was a little slow on the update, but the combination of meth and ecstasy, the print on this memo you gave us in our notebooks, a little too small for me to read.
Oh, sorry.
It's microscopic. And I wanted to read it because I want to know, why is this being done? Is this to generate more people hooked on meth, or is it to dilute the product, or why is this the new combination of choice by illegal markets?
Well, and I think we have our suspicions, but with Senator Walker, with the caveat that it is only our suspicions, and you can't base anything on it, I think it may be a combination of both of the things you suspect. I think it may be that largely the manufacturers of the tabs that reach us here from Canada, for example, these are organizations that manufacture both MDMA and meth. And so if they're short on MDMA, they supplement it with meth, and so they can get some level of potency, so people feel like they aren't getting ripped off to some degree. And I think it also may be possibly a marketing strategy to get people hooked on meth, not just using ecstasy. Either one of those is scary to me to some extent, but I don't know what the real motivation is.
It's very scary to me because those are date rape drugs, and they're often slipped into drinks when women aren't looking, and it's of high concern to me because they're not making the choice. They didn't make the choice when it was just ecstasy, and now they're not making the choice when they get crystal meth in their drink either. So I think it's something to be very concerned about.
It is. I'm very concerned. All right. Prescription drug monitoring, just to let you know where we're at. A lot of the results are in from the prescription drug abuse that has gone on around the nation and the prescription drug monitoring programs. We still rest almost uniquely as one of the only states that doesn't have a prescription drug monitoring program. I won't give you my whole song and dance and pitch on that, but I put that bug in your ear because we truly are now surrounded by states that have PDMPs operating. And basically, PDMPs operate to allow doctors a central database to look into to make sure their patients aren't doctor shopping, not only to make doctors feel more comfortable that they can prescribe pain meds for their patients, but I think PDMPs are something you're going to wind up having to look at sooner or later to avoid Oregon becoming what it is now, which is a destination resort for doctor shopping and prescription drug abuse. Underage drinking, of course, is something that we focused on off and on for a lot of years. The Oregon data is not good, and it's not getting any better. The Attorney General has just reformed, and we had our first task force meeting yesterday. He reformed his underage drinking task force, and will probably be coming to you in the 09 session, obviously not the 08 session, but we're coming to you in the 09 session with a package of proposals to try to get a handle on what has become truly a crisis in the state of Oregon in terms of our underage drinking rates and its impact on society. In terms of a plan of action, we have a lot to build on. There's been a lot of reports, a lot of work done. We've experimented here in the state of Oregon with a lot of different things. We can learn not only from ourselves, but from others, what works and what doesn't. It all gets back to the same old trusty three-legged stool of prevention, enforcement, and treatment. And again, we've learned a lot about what works and what doesn't on each of these legs. I'm going to talk first about prevention. We've learned that you can't scare kids into not using drugs. We've learned that fear-based messages don't work. We've learned that one-time shots don't work. We've also learned what does work through a variety of science-based studies. Community coalitions are one of the primary things that work, not only to raise community awareness, but to empower communities to take action on issues relating to substance abuse and early intervention. Unfortunately, and we've done a pretty good job of ramping up some of this in the last couple of biennium, but unfortunately, Oregon is the model of how to do this right. We were a national model back in the late 1980s and the early 1990s about how to do community coalitions right, and we abandoned that model in 1995. So we've proven not only how to do it right, but how to do it wrong, and hopefully we can switch back to doing things the right way and actually providing some direct baseline funding for community coalitions that empower communities to take control of the addiction and a public awareness going on in their community. I think we've done a pretty good job of community education. I think you would be hard-pressed to find another state where the public doesn't know more about meth. We've done a lot of public education through a lot of different mechanisms here in the state of Oregon. And I think we'll continue to do that, and I think it's important. But I think it's also important that we be careful not to engage in fear-mongering and just fear-based messages, that we tell the truth about meth, because the truth is scary enough. We don't have to ramp up the fear on meth.
A lot more to do.
Unfortunately, we have not been a very good model on this front. We know what works when it comes to preventing drug addiction with our youth, and we know what doesn't work. I've already talked about what doesn't work, which is one-time shots and fear-based messages. We know the science tells us, decades of science tells us, how to get good outcomes in terms of youth not becoming addicted to substances. And that's comprehensive K-12 prevention curriculum. Pre-K-12 prevention curriculum. We have Oregon administrative rules that require that every school does this right now, in existence. But we have never funded it, not a single dime. We have prevention curriculum sitting on the school shelves in each school in the state of Oregon. Some schools are doing some very creative things, but it's all without funding. We need to start talking about that and talking about how to do this right based on, frankly, the lessons we can learn from other states. In terms of enforcement, there's a lot to talk about here, but I know time is running short. There has been some progress. I applaud what you've done, especially for the Oregon State Police in terms of starting to restore some of its capacity to address some of these important issues, and particularly in respect to the drug enforcement section, but the OSP overall, as well as the lab, which all of our district attorneys and law enforcement rely upon to complete their cases. There's another big gap, however, and I think you're facing this issue here, and hopefully you're going to address this here, that's going to confront the Oregon voters in November of this year, which is the gap. And there is a gap, and let's just acknowledge it and start to address it in a thoughtful manner. And the gap is this. If you're not a significant enough drug dealer, if you're not a significant enough property criminal, that you go into the federal system and spend significant time in federal prison, our current state system spins you through a revolving door of justice. There are people that are above the level of mere addicts committing minor crimes, and the significant dealers with significant dollars that are purveying lots of drugs on our streets that hit the federal system. There is this gap of folks that we spin through the system that frustrates our law enforcement officers, that frustrates our district attorneys, and frustrates our ability to hold people accountable for their conduct. Now, I know we are facing Initiative Petition 40 in November of 2008. I support a lot of the background of what is driving IP40, it's driven by frustration, by the frustration of that revolving door. I, however, view it as basically trying to perform surgery with a sledgehammer. We may kill the patient in the process. I think I would strongly encourage you to seriously come up with an alternative to IP40 that does address the real a gap and the lack of accountability we see in those mid-level offenders. We have to address that, and I think you have to address it seriously. Otherwise, IP40 is going to pass. And if IP40 is going to pass, we're going to have to deal with the patient that just been sledgehammered. And I'll be here. I'm happy to be here in 2009 to help you deal with it. But I'd rather do it in a surgical manner that makes sense to address the gap and address the enforcement issues that we have here in Oregon today. Briefly about treatment. We've made a lot of progress, and I have to give you a lot of praise for helping us turn the corner on what has become an incredible tragedy. As I told you last time, Oregon ranked fourth in the nation for treatment demand per capita by young adults, but 49th in the nation for treatment access for that same critical core population. We've made progress since then. We started to invest and reinvest in treatment, but I also applaud you for doing it in a thoughtful manner, not just dumping money and throwing money at things without some evidence that they work. And I think it's important to say, I know you've heard this before, but I'll say it for the audience as well, treatment works for meth addicts. Treatment works for meth addicts as well as it works for any other form of addiction. We have decades of treatment science to prove it, but there are differences. And when we throw money at treatment, forms of treatment that don't work, it's not that we're wasting money. We do occasionally get some good outcomes on those things, but it's better to be thoughtful and methodical about spending our money wisely to get really good outcomes. And I am not a treatment provider. I can't pretend to be, but and I distill all the treatment talk into these three key words, because I've seen the difference between treatment and recovery support that works for meth addicts and treatment and recovery support that doesn't. And it all seems to break down into these three words. Modality. We know that if you use cognitive types of therapy for meth addicts, you get bad results. And that's because a lot of meth addicts have suffered cognitive impairment. If they can't remember what you're telling them, if they can't process what you're telling them, it doesn't sink in. Time. We know how meth affects the brain, especially the pleasure center of the brain and dopamine receptors. We know that it takes a lot of time for recovery. On average, 9 months just to recover dopamine receptors and transmitters and normal dopamine operation. That's normal pleasure in life. That's not true for a lot of other drugs of addiction. So we know the time necessary for not just treatment, but for recovery support is elongated. We also know that accountability is crucial, especially for meth addicts to get successful outcomes in treatment and recovery support. And when I talk about accountability, it can be something as simple as constant random urinalysis to ensure sobriety. When you combine those three things correctly, you get great outcomes, as good outcomes as for treating any other form of addiction. And so you have, thankfully...
Mr. Robert?
Yes.
1 second. Sure, Senator.
Thank you. You've just described a drug court, I think.
I did.
But I want to go back to the modality on the cognitive modality, and what do you use instead that works if you're not going to use cognitive techniques?
Well, and there are, Senator Burke, there are a number of models, and I'll give you my caveat. You know, I'm a law enforcement guy, so ask me treatment questions, it's real dicey to begin with. But, you know, I have studied at a 50,000 foot superficial level kind of what they've been doing. I think a lot of it's been pioneered by, for example, Professor Down at UCLA. He's developed a matrix model of a system that basically provides treatment and restructuring someone's lives in terms of how they do things rather than how necessarily they think about things. And I know that they would not describe it that way. It's more of a conduct and repetitive and habit-based analysis than essentially getting someone to realize what they've done to their lives. It's the way I would describe it in generic terms, but that's probably totally inaccurate, and if Dr. Rich Rosen was sitting next to me from UCLA, he'd probably be appalled that I just described it that way.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. You're talking about Dr. Rosen's approach. In your experience, is that being used in drug courts in Oregon effectively?
Senator Berg, I think that's one example of many similar approaches that are being used in drug court, yes. And in other models that build in not only the correct modality, but the time for recovery support and the high levels of accountability.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, so we'll obviously be coming back to you for ramping up treatment that works. And there's a lot of different examples, as we talked about. Drug court is a perfect example. I think where we're at right now is we have a golden opportunity, the way I describe it, with meth purity plummeting and meth price increasing and local toxic meth labs nearly eliminated from the state of Oregon. I think the time is now to change what has been. I wish we could change it at a national level, but we can only deal with what we can deal with here in Oregon. Nobody's appointing me drug czar tomorrow. If we could, I would love to erase 150 years of drug control policy based on fear. We need to start basing drug control policy on science. And I think we have started that approach in 2005. I think we continued that approach in 2007, and I would encourage you to continue that approach not only in 2008 in terms of addressing and dealing with IP40, but in terms of your overall policy that you develop in 2009. Let's implement policies based on science and prevention, enforcement, and treatment to break the cycle of addiction and deal with the underlying issue of addiction where we can save lives and families and have a real impact on the quality of life in the state of Oregon. So that's what I have for you. I know I skimmed over a ton of material. I don't know if Mike has anything he wants to add on the drug enforcement section of the state police, but I was kind of the guinea pig selected to come up and present all this information to you.
Two questions.
Lieutenant, let's proceed.
I have two questions. I'll make them brief. One is just a comment, and I appreciated that you talked about the reduction in property crimes pretty much significantly in Oregon. We lead the 12 states, so IP40 certainly is a sledgehammer. The second one is the Mexican drug cartels. You talked about, well, we knew that was going to happen, and apparently President Calderon has really taken this seriously. Is there anything more that we need to do in Oregon or in this country to stop the influx of the cartels, or does this really rest with Mexico?
That's the $64,000 question we address at a national level. I think it's, Senator Walker, I think it's both. I think we have to stay on task. We have to stay on this. We have to continue to work with other nations to not only share the positive things we've done, but the negative things we've done as well. And it's amazing how we get feedback. So when we go to these international conferences and we talk to the Mexican delegation or the British delegation or whoever it happens to be, it's an interesting exchange sometimes because we also pick up things from them. And so I think we have to continue to work with the international community to spread the message about what's working and what's not working based on science. I think when we look insular, sometimes we look for that quick fix. We look for that, if we could just scare the kids or whatever it happens to be, and we default to what feels good at the moment. I think this is a long-term project. And I think we have to address it internationally, nationally, and in the state of Oregon in a comprehensive way.
Thank you. Yeah, reefer madness never worked in the 60s, and it's not going to work today.
It was entertaining. It's
pretty funny.
And if I could just throw in a couple more just quick comments, because it made me recall a couple things. And I won't, again, much like the property crime data, I can't and won't ascribe any reason for it because the data is too new. But our arrest data trends in Oregon on meth look good as well. And I think, and it's just pure speculation, that the overall market disruption that you've seen in terms of meth purity, meth price, meth labs going down may be the reason, but we just can't say exactly the specific reasons. But the meth arrest data has been provided to you as a supplement to the Governor's Meth Task Force report that was handed out to you. And then the second thing that I probably didn't fully flesh out for you, when it comes to prevention, and I did mention that, I mean, we've been a leader. We're being looked at as a model for a lot of these things. When it comes to prevention, we used to be a leader. We used to be a model. I'd like to get back to that model from the late 80s and the early 90s, where we actually provided some baseline funding. We provided some baseline support for community coalitions that were engaged in these activities, and I already mentioned the K-12 schools. And Oregon Partnership is our statewide prevention coalition. But for the last decade or so, that funding has pretty much disappeared. And some of the communities have picked themselves up by the bootstraps and done a lot of great work on grassroots. But, you know, it's tragic to me on the prevention side that we actually invented the model. We invented the national model, and then we abandoned it when it was working really good. So on the prevention thing, I think that we have to go back to what we were doing before and prove that we could do incredibly well.
And before we take out the questions, I'm going to give the lieutenant an opportunity if he wants to comment anywhere on the drug enforcement side or anything else you'd like to add to the presentation.
Mr. Chair, as usual, Rob did an excellent job there, so he's kind of a hard act to follow, but I'll just be here in case you have any questions. I think Rob did an excellent job of summing up where we're at.
Senator Shields. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having worked on the Public Safety Strategies Task Force, Rob, I wanted to perhaps agree with your comment about cognitive drug and alcohol treatment, but perhaps limit its scope a little bit. I think that the research that I've seen is that with, you know, several months of abstinence, the brain does recover some, and that I'm not sure if the doctor from UCLA would agree completely that cognitive programming was wrong. It just might need to be coupled with other therapeutic approaches, behavioral approaches.
And Representative Shields, I would agree. That sounds like Dr. Russ, and so you do a better job at being him than I do.
I just wanted to, because we have funded cognitive behavioral programs in prisons, and I didn't want to give the impression that we shouldn't be doing that. Secondly, if it's okay, do we have any sense of, I know arrests are down, property crime is way down, and it shows that we're moving in the right direction. I know that the state has kept treatment admissions data per capita. Do we have any of that information for 05 or 06? Does DHS have that?
Representative Shields, I believe DHS does have all of the treatment admissions data. My only caution on using that data is this. Treatment admissions is largely dependent upon treatment availability. So our treatment admissions data is not really that high right now compared to where we were 6 or 7 years ago, and that's a function of us, you know, 4 or 5, 6 biennia ago, gutting treatment capacity.
Follow-up, just still, I think it would be interesting to see the data if DHS could get it for us.
And Representative, I'll ask Karen Wheeler from DHS to see if we can get that for you.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions? Senator Vincent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You spoke about community education. I think one of the leaders in that has been Patsy Smullen, or KOBI, KYTI TV network. I think she has 7 stations. That material is actually on the website, and I think that it would be very worthwhile if, with the chair's permission, sometime if you could perhaps show us some of those spot ads. Christine Anderson is probably one of the more credible people I've ever seen in the schools. She is just awesome. And it's not a scare tactic, it's an education tactic. This is what you look like, this is what this girl looked like 3 years ago, this is what she looks like today, and do you want to do that? Or is there a better way? So I think at a later time, if we could get some of those spots, there are 30-second, 1-minute spots, and I mean, they are hard-hitting and they are good.
I agree. If there's nothing further, then thank you very much, Mr. Bovet and Lieutenant Dingaman. It was an excellent presentation, and it's great to see the positive report about the partial success we've had with the people in the home cooking event. That was a complete success, I think, but there's obviously a lot more work to be done. So thank you very much.
Rob, I just want to say thank you. I know you put in a lot of effort and time, and also to your county, to allow you to actually take the message beyond our borders, because it seems like the success we have is a model that hopefully other states and the national level will actually implement.
Thank you. Now, in terms of managing our calendar here, I see that we have Attorney General Myers in the room. And Mr. Myers, are you here for both for the presentation of LC 58 and for Ms. Hutanen's presentation on the sexual offense, or just the former? Why don't we open a work session now of the House Judiciary Committee to take up LC 58 and invite Attorney General Myers and see Mr. Shepard in the audience as well to look forward to present on that.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, Chair Przanski, members of the Interim Judiciary Committees. For the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and joined by Deputy Attorney General Pete Shepard. And we have a few moments on our agenda to give you a status report on the development of legislation for the February session that would implement the joint resolutions relating to crime victims' rights if either or both of those measures is approved by the people at the special election set to coincide with the primary in May. When I appeared before the committees last year to encourage your support of the concept of the development of this legislation, I indicated to you that I would be appointing, if that support were forthcoming from you, I would be appointing a working group to develop the recommended measure for session introduction. I have done so, and I would, I may like to have, at some point, I'd like to have distributed to you the roster of the work group just for your information, so that you can see who has been in.
Sure, but if you could get it to his word over here.
I think also distributed to you is the current draft of the measure LC58, and I want to, what I'd like to do is just give you a fairly high-level overview of the measure rather than descend into a lot of detail. Any specific questions we'll certainly try to deal with, of course, but in the interest of your time, I can give you a little bit higher-level overview. You can at least see how we are fitting the measure together and what major objectives we are pursuing with the measure. The overall purpose of the measure, of course, is to tell the criminal justice process how it is to implement the people's decision if they approve either or both the joint resolutions, because that's going to be a policy decision by the people of Oregon that they want the constitutional rights of crime victims in fact recognized in the criminal proceeding, in the judicial process. And the goal of the legislation is to tell the process how that is to occur, because right now there is no guidance for the process, and it was really to provide that guidance should the measures be approved, either or both in May, to provide that guidance as soon as the measures become effective. That really was the underpinning of my urging your approval and support for this in the February session. The draft before you will be further modified. The working group is going to meet at least two times more by the 22nd, which will be the culminating date of our work for Legislative Council in order to be able to create a final formal draft for introduction. But if I could direct your attention to the draft for a moment. The draft opens with one provision that will be effective regardless of the outcome of the election, and that is a provision which would empower the Attorney General to adopt rules necessary to administer and effectuate rights granted by Sections 42 and 43 of Article 1, the sections that are affected by the joint resolutions. And that provision is in there because, quite separate from this implementation measure, there is a Crime Victims' Rights Compliance Project which has been conducted by the Oregon Department of Justice under a federal USDOJ grant. And that process is going to produce a more informal, non-judicial procedure by which alleged violations of victims' rights can be reported and considered. It's completely supplemental to or independent of the formal process that's set forth in this measure. That rulemaking authority is sought from the legislature simply to be able to provide some kind of legal underpinning for that separate, more informal, non-judicial process. Thereafter, then, the measure, the first segment of the measure, are the provisions that would be effective if both of the joint resolutions are approved by the people in May. We have in Section 2 certain definitions. In Section 3, we establish the right of the victim to assert a claim personally through an attorney or through an authorized prosecuting attorney, and we prohibit the charging of any kind of filing service or hearing fee incident to those proceedings. Then Section 4 is the provision of the bill that really seeks to guide the system in a way that will avoid violations of victims' rights. And it seeks to accomplish that by a combination of certificates of compliance that are provided or that are filed by district attorneys, as well as colloquies between the court and usually the district attorney or the victim or both at each of the critical stages of the proceeding as those are defined back in the definitions section. So that is really a compliance achieving section, Section 4. Section 5 is the section that tells a victim who wishes to allege that there has been a violation of rights how to do that. And then the section goes on to provide how the court is to process a claim of process and resolve a claim of violation. Section 6 likewise pertains to the processing or handling and deciding of claims of violation. Section 7 defines circumstances when a claim has been waived. Then in Section 8, we begin the judicial review provisions of the measure. One point I will note specifically, and probably would catch the eyes certainly of lawyers on the two committees, and that is that on page 11 of the measure, it provides that proceedings for appellate review will be instituted in the Supreme Court of Oregon, which is vested with exclusive and original jurisdiction. That particular provision was requested or recommended by the Judicial Department, which is represented by two persons on the work group, and I presume, of course, that was after consultation with the Chief Justice and the Supreme Court, possibly the Court of Appeals. So that rather unusual kind of investment of jurisdiction, which would usually be in the Court of Appeals, is in this bill in the Supreme Court by request of the Judicial Department. The remainder of the bill, sections 9 and section 10, provides that appellate review, it would be a matter of right in all cases involving a felony or a person class A misdemeanor. And thereafter, we provide that in all other circumstances, the appellate review of the decision of the trial court would be discretionary. Section 11 describes how the review is to be conducted and decisions issued. Then Section 12, we impose on the Attorney General a requirement that prior to the first appellate court appearance in which the State of Oregon is a party, the Attorney General will determine whether the Department of Justice has taken all reasonably practicable steps to fulfill rights granted by the Constitution and file a certification to that effect with the first appearance. Section 13 invests the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to establish requirements and procedures necessary for the judicial branch of state government to comply with the provisions of Section 2 to 14 of the Act. Then, necessarily, the measure has to deal with the contingencies of one measure passing and one not passing. So, a number of the succeeding sections of the bill are addressing one or the other of those outcomes, essentially by repeating or not repeating some of the provisions of the original sections 2 to 14. And that accounts for quite a lot of the measure all the way through to section, all the way to page 51.
I would suggest that probably don't have to spend much attention on that because that possibility seems quite an unlikelihood to this observer.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think that's correct, but we felt it was absolutely would be absolutely necessary to at least have that contingency addressed in the measure itself. Then the concluding portions of the measure are very statutory amendments and repeals, including these provisions, which are still in discussion and review, will also seek to address the circumstances under which a proceeding involving a claim of violation can affect an extension or delay of the running of the 60-day speedy trial period of our statutes. So in sum, Chair McPherson, Chair Pozanski, and members, the measure will seek to inform instruct the criminal justice process how it is to deal with the approval of either or both of the joint resolutions in terms of both seeking to avoid the occurrence of violations of rights, as well as the prescription of how claims of violation are to be made and processed by the system, and then what appellate rights and procedures will apply. We think that those, in large terms, those are the three major components of the measure that will, I'm sure, be part of a measure, but the detail of them is still being worked through and refined. We will conclude, as I say, the work group's work in that regard on the 22nd. My hope is that the product of that process will be a clean, clear measure for recommended introduction that will have the support, or the at least the neutrality, of all the perspectives that are represented on the work group. I make no representation to you at this time as to whether that will occur, but that's certainly my objective, and I believe there's ongoing and current interaction between various members of the work group and their constituencies, if you will, to try to keep them informed of the progress of the work group and to provide a basis for final round input into our discussions before we complete work on the 22nd. So we hope that the resultant measure will be one that will be broadly supported and will be a good, sound point of departure for the Assembly to take up when you begin your deliberations in February.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Myers. You'll recall, committee, that this was the concept that we approved at our November meeting and then submitted for drafting, so that we, as has been explained, so that we are queued up in anticipation of a favorable vote on the measures that we referred to the May ballot. And we just got an explanation of where it stands, but we are at the date for taking action to introduce the bill, even though there are still further discussions to go on. So those will have to be accomplished with an amendment to that would be then considered in our upcoming supplemental session. Any questions for Mr. Myers? Then, hearing none, then the chair would invite a motion to introduce LC 58 as a committee bill of the House Judiciary Committee in the upcoming supplemental session. Representative Wisnett has moved that we introduce LC 58 as a committee bill of the House Interim Judiciary Committee at the upcoming supplemental session. Is there a discussion of the motion?
Mr. Chair, I beg your pardon. Could I
please
make a comment? It was my understanding, Mr. Chair, that the intention was to make the introduction measure the formal LC measure that would emerge from the work group process sometime following the 22nd, and that it would be, if it were not possible at that later time for the committee to act on the measure, that it would be introduced by the House leadership, probably as a representative, perhaps as a committee bill, I'm not sure, but the measure going into the session would be the product of the full efforts of the work group translated into a formal, final LC draft.
And there was a timing constraint that I thought was that we requiring introduction a certain amount of time in advance, and Council Taylor's maybe needs to be...
introduced by the 28th.
The 28th. I stand corrected. And in any event, I see I also see that I was not following my notes here correctly, that actually the action taken, all the bill introductions are being handled by the Rules Committee, and so our action is actually to recommend introduction to the Rules Committee. I think what I'll do is actually ask for a withdrawal of that motion, Representative, if we could, and then I think the motion that I'll invite is one to recommend to the Rules Committee the introduction of LC 58 with the modifications to be developed yet by the continuing work of the work group.
Do I see that?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
You've heard the motion, which is that the House Judiciary Committee approve LC 58 as a recommendation to the Rules Committee for introduction in the upcoming session with such modifications as is made by the work group in its meetings that are scheduled here later this month. Is there any discussion of the motion? Hearing none, then any objection? If not, then the motion is adopted. And I thank the work group. Please extend our thanks to the work group for developing this legislation, Mr. Myers, and we appreciate your presentation today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I will close the work session of the House Judiciary Committee and we'll resume the informational meeting that we were proceeding on. And the next item on the agenda is an information report by Dave Hendricks, the Legislative Council, on the recent decision in Clark v. OHSU.
Chair McPherson, Chair Pozanski, Dave Hendricks from the Legislative Council's office. Good morning. I don't have a PowerPoint presentation for you this morning, so you just have to put up with me droning on a little bit. I was asked to come forward and explain a little bit the case that came down from Oregon Supreme Court last month, Clark versus OHSU, a case which has significant impact on Oregon's Tort Claim Act. And what I'll do is, for the benefit of the members, remind them at first what the Oregon Tort Claim Act is so you get some context for the significance of the decision. Up until the 1960s, the state claimed sovereign immunity for purposes of claims that were made against it. And what that means is if I was a state employee and I went out and took a state motor pool car and was going to some function that was a state function where it was very clear I was in the course and scope of my employment, and I ran into somebody, I blew a stop sign, ran into the side of another vehicle, and that person said, "Wow, you know, you blew that, and you did great damage, and I suffered a lot of injuries." And they said, "You know, I'm going to sue the state because you're clearly acting on behalf of the state at this point, and so I should be able to go file a claim against them and say, you guys are responsible for what your employee did." But what sovereign immunity said was, no, you can't sue the state. You don't have that ability. You could sue the person, the employee, and that becomes very important when we start talking about Clark versus OHSU, but you could not sue the state. And that was premised on the concept that the king could do no wrong, that in effect that there was nothing that the king would do that would give you a claim back against the king for that type of injury. In 1967, the legislature decided that they would waive part of that sovereign immunity. They apparently decided that maybe the king could do some wrong and essentially gave the right to that person to say, yeah, maybe under those circumstances you can sue the state if you can show that indeed this person is negligent. But they didn't waive it entirely. They didn't say, you can sue us for whatever your damages may be. They partially waived. They said, you can sue, but only up to a given amount, and at that time it was like $100,000. It's currently now for an individual about $200,000 for injuries suffered in an accident. So those caps that you hear about, the caps on the liability of the state, really, when you look at them from that point of view, they're not really capped so much as they're just the extent to which we waive the liability and said that much and no more. What happened next was is that over the course of the next 30 or 40 years, there were further developments in the Tort Claim Act. The first thing that happened that was significant was in 1975, the state decided that they would indemnify their employees and officers for claims that were made against them. Now, mind you, that what that meant was that under the laws that then stood, the person who was injured had two defendants they could go after. They could go after the state, who in effect had an insurance policy because they said, we'll pay up to this amount. And they also had the option of going against the employee who had the accident. In 1975, the state said, look, you're our employee, you're working on our behalf, what we're going to do is say, if you get sued because of something we do in employment, we're going to provide you with a defense. We'll have somebody from the Department of Justice who is going to defend you, or perhaps from a private firm, and we are going to pay any judgment that may come against you. And so, in effect, at that point, the state said, we will be your insurer as the employee, and we will provide coverage for you. During this period, I think it was a little clearer about the extent to which the caps, the $100,000 at that point, really applied to the liability of the employee. I haven't gone back and searched this out to see how many cases might have come down. I think at that time there may have been some assumption that was the case, but I don't think it was necessarily true. That did finally occur, though, in 1991, because what happened at that point was the Department of Justice came in with a bill to the legislature and said, you know, look, what we're going to do is we're going to say that when you sue someone based on a public employee based on something they did in the course and scope of their employment, that your only remedy is going to be to sue the public body. In fact, you have to take the private individual off the complaint. The only person you're going to be able to sue is the public body. So if it's a state employee, you have to sue the state, and they're going to be the main defendant. And, by the way, you're subject to the limits on the state. The state has imposed with respect to how much you can sue us for. So you can only collect the $200,000 that we provided at that time. So that was a very significant change. In effect, the state said, not only are we going to provide insurance for the purposes of this employment, say we will pay any claims against you, they then said, we are the only one you can sue. You can no longer sue that individual. So you're stuck with us, and plus you're stuck with the caps. I would say throughout the 20th century, the legislature felt pretty free as far as limiting liability and changing the claim types of relief that people could claim in lawsuits. It didn't make a whole lot of difference through much of the century, though, because there were not that many laws passed, frankly, that addressed tort liability. And that's a fairly recent development, most of which happened in the 80s and 90s, frequently under the rubric of tort reform, as people became concerned about the size of jury verdicts and decided to step in and try to make some additional changes and put some limits on what could be awarded in lawsuits. There were some old cases that suggested that indeed you could do this. There was a case back from 1935 called Perozzi versus Garnier, where the Oregon Supreme Court said that the legislature could abolish a claim for release, a common law claim for relief, which would suggest that the legislature had a lot of power to be able to go in and tinker with the remedies that were available to people who suffered injuries. But with the legislation that came along in the 80s and 90s, and this wasn't just in Oregon, this was going around through many, many states where this was occurring, there was an increased interest in the courts in looking at some of the constitutional provisions that had always been there but had not been given much use in the past. Things like Article 1, Section 10, which indicates in Oregon's constitution that every man shall have a remedy by due course of law for injury done to him in his person, property, or reputation, the so-called remedies clause. The other one they looked at was the Oregon Constitution's constitutional provision that guaranteed every person a right to jury trial in civil matters. And the laws that we're looking at, the principal law, the one that really kind of started the sequence of events that led to Clark versus OHSU, was a law that was passed in 1987 as part of a huge package of measures that address torts generally and insurance for liability insurance, etc. The key provision of which, I think, in most people's mind was a cap on the amount of non-economic damages that could be awarded in a lawsuit. And the cap was $500,000. They said, you know, if you sue someone for a personal injury, the automobile accident, no matter what it was, malpractice made no difference. If it was one of those tort claims, there's going to be a cap on the amount of non-economic damages you can get. And non-economic damages really translates into pain and suffering. And it's a good example in the Clark case. In the Clark case, the individual was severely injured by reason of claimed medical malpractice, and this person is going to have basically a lifetime of a very bad health situation, and the agreed amount on that particular incident was $5 million for what was essentially going to be a lifetime of not very good health and pain and suffering. Well, the law in 1987, when it came down, it stood till 1999. And that's when the case came along, when the Supreme Court started to start looking at some of these caps and laws passed by the legislature addressing liability. And they came down in the case of Lakin v. Senko in 1999. Those of us who are around remember, because it came down right at the end of session, and we did a try to address it. And that case actually relied on the right to jury trial to say that that cap was invalid, that it was facially void, at least for purposes of claims that were available in 1857. So the case really did two things, at least from my point of view, when it came down. For one thing, it said, oh, they're going to take some of these provisions. I mean, this was really the first time that particular constitutional provision had been used in that way, to basically say there was a limit on the ability of the legislature to eliminate remedies or to cap remedies that were available in 1857 at the time the Constitution was adopted here in Oregon. It also emphasized the fact that they were really serious about this historical analysis of the Oregon Constitution to figure out what it meant. They literally were going to go back and look at the historical materials in 1850s to find out what was available and say that's what was being protected by that provision of the Constitution. So that was the two things that it said at that point. Boy, we're going to, these provisions are now going to come into play, and there's going to be some limits on what the legislature can do. And B, it's going to be based on historical analysis, what was going on in 1857. And a lot of us at that point said, gee, I wonder what this does to the Tort Claims Act. And I believe there was a memo I prepared and submitted to committee in which I was trying to list what the effects of Lakin could be, and one of them was the Tort Claims Act. And the specific reason given for that was, as I mentioned before, in 1857, no, you could not sue the state. They had sovereign immunity. But in 1857, you could sue the employee. And I mean, that just, I think it jumped out to a lot of people and said, okay, there's some question here about the ability of the state to say, your only remedy is to come back and sue the state. You have no longer any remedy against that individual. And not only that, all you're going to get is what we've allowed you to sue for, the $200,000. What then happened was another case came down directly addressed at the Tort Claims Act, and it happened in 2002. It was called Jensen v. Whitlow. And I'm sorry for this long history, but I think it'll help when we get to the Clark case to have this history, because if I just told you what Clark said without this sort of background, it's harder to understand what they're saying and why they're saying it. Jensen v. Whitlow came to the court from the federal courts, where the federal courts had the ability to certify questions to the Oregon Supreme Court to say, what is your law on this point? Because we have this issue over here about Oregon constitutional law, and they'll send it back to the Oregon Supreme Court because it's more appropriate forum to decide what the Oregon Constitution means to have the Oregon Supreme Court decide it. And the question that was directly presented was, is the Tort Claims Act constitutional? You know, you've got these cases that have come down that suggest, just as I said, that perhaps you don't have the ability to say that the state is the only defendant and you can only collect this much. Because of the way it came to the court, there had been no judgment in the case at that point. The case was pending. There had been no award. Nobody knew how much was going to be awarded. And what the Supreme Court said in Jensen was, we're not going to say the statute is just unconstitutional. But it says it's going to depend. It says they look back at all their cases, and what they said was, and this goes back actually to the workers' compensation system, which came down in the early 1900s. you can look at the workers' compensation system and say, well, how does that work? I mean, in 1857, I could sue my employer, and I could perhaps get a very large judgment against my employer. I did have to show that the employer was somehow negligent or at fault, but I could do that. Well, in about, I think it was 1913, I think that's when they did workers' comp, when they brought that in, there was a case that was actually brought to challenge whether or not workers' comp was constitutional. I can't even remember if they talked about Article 1, Section 10. But implicit within the approval of the workers' compensation system was the concept that, well, you know, the state does have the ability to get rid of the ability to sue if you provide some other mechanism, some other way for this person to get a remedy. And in workers' compensation, you lost a lot because you can no longer sue and maybe get fairly large damages. I mean, the amounts that were payable under the workers' comp system, even at that time, you know, at that time were very low. They've grown over the years, but at that time they were very small. And the court basically, the implicit within the approval of that system was the idea that you can substitute a system as long as, in subsequences, what they would say, as long as there is a substantial remedy. Something more than just an emasculated remedy, as some of the cases said. Something substantial, and not only that, you get some other, in workers' comp, you got an additional benefit if you were the worker, several additional benefits actually. A, you didn't have to go to court. You know, it's expensive and time-consuming and unsure what you're going to get if you go to court. So you don't have to. You've got this fairly quick mechanism to get a payment. And more significantly, you didn't have to show that the employer was at fault. It's a no-fault system. If you're hurt on the job and it's in the course and scope of your employment, it doesn't make any difference if the employer did anything wrong. You still get to collect. So there were trade-offs. And basically, the court in the Jensen case was looking back and said, well, we've got kind of something like that here with the Torts Claim Act. You know, you used to be able to sue the employee to get some recovery of the state. The state has provided an alternative remedy here. They said you can sue, directly sue the state, something you didn't used to be able to do. Now, mind you, there's going to be limits on what you can collect, but it is an alternative remedy. And they said, we're not prepared to say that this isn't an adequate remedy. And they said it may depend on how much of a disparity is between what an individual client, or excuse me, an individual claimant has put in versus the $200,000 cap. And they said, until we know in this case how much is actually awarded, what the damage is, we're not prepared to say that it isn't an adequate remedy. So what they did was, is they suggested, in fact, they literally said, you can have this sort of system, but it needs to provide an adequate remedy to people, and we're not prepared to say that in this case because we don't know yet whether or not this is a, you know, how much is going to be awarded. So they declined to strike down the whole law and just say, no, you can't do this. They basically left you to look at individual cases, and that's what's known as an as-applied analysis, as opposed to a facial challenge saying the whole thing said, no, how did it get applied to this individual? Well, that was just an open invitation for the next case that came along in which there was a large award of damages against an employee where the cap was imposed, and for them to come back and say, okay, here's the case. This is the case where, indeed, you have an award. In the case of Clark versus OHSU, the award was $17 million. And the state essentially went in and said, well, we'll basically concede on this. We'll say, yeah, there was negligence here, and yes, there was damages, and here's your $200,000. And that was the case that went up to the Supreme Court in Clark versus OHSU. It said basically, you know, this plaintiff would be left with $200,000 basically as the judgment on an amount that state would have conceded as $17 million being the actual damages suffered by this individual. What the Oregon Supreme Court said with Clark versus OHSU directly followed from what they had already basically pre-announced in the Jensen case. They looked at it and they said, no, this ain't an adequate remedy. $200,000 for a $17 million plant is not an adequate remedy. So as with respect to this particular case, we're going to tell you the cap can't be applied. This person is entitled to collect the $17 million. The thing about that decision that is going to be difficult for the legislature and for Department of Justice to defend these cases and to agencies is that the court tells you nothing about how much would have constituted. How, for instance, I'll give you some examples. Clearly, $17,200,000 not enough. Well, what about five? What if there was a $5 million judgment? Would $200,000 be enough then? How about $1 million? How about $400,000? If there was a $400,000 judgment, would $200,000 be an adequate remedy? You know, we don't know. And we won't know until we get further cases or unless the legislature takes further action to try to address it. The state is self-insured through DAS, Department of Administrative Services. They have what's called the Risk Management Division. They actually collect premiums from all state agencies. The legislature is insured through them for liability. Our office pays a small premium for our coverage for liability, possibility of liability to risk management. What the practical significance of Clark is that risk management, who's always assumed previously that $200,000 was the maximum claim for any individual, now no longer knows. And what's kind of strange about it is the bigger the claim is, the more likely that the claim will have to be paid. You know, if it's a $400,000 judgment, there's an argument to be said, well, that's an adequate remedy, so you only get the $200,000 would be an adequate remedy, so that's what you get. If it's a $10 million claim, they may have to pay that. So what's going to happen is that, as it now stands, I think all state agencies will experience an increase in the contribution rates that they have to make for risk management. Local governments, of course, some are self-insured, some are insured through policies. They will have to think in terms of higher rates for their insurance, and it will kind of filter. And with school districts, of course, it will come back into the legislature through the amounts of funding for the school districts because they, of course, all were underneath the Torts Claim Act as well and now have got this uncertainty. A couple of things I'll say and then I'll shut up and go to questions. First thing is this. The Clark case did not affect the responsibility of the state and of public bodies generally to indemnify their employees. So what that means is the fact that now some employees may get sued for $17 million doesn't affect the responsibility of OHSU to pay that judgment. So as the law stands now, unless it's changed somehow, the duty to basically pay the judgment on behalf of employees remains. In fact, that's how come the impact of this case is really on the public bodies. It's not on the employees. Even though the decision is, yeah, you can go ahead and sue the employees, because the law currently provides for indemnification of those employees to pay the judgments that may be entered against them, the state will continue to have to do that. That's how come the impact is on the state. And so let's talk about options, you know, for the legislature at this point. And there seems to me there are several. There's a very interesting concurring opinion in the Clark case by Justice Ballmer. He was joined in that concurring opinion by Justice Kistler, and it'd be interesting to know how the other four members who participated in the case felt about that concurring opinion. It suggests several things about the rationale for the decision and possible avenues for the legislature, although there's certainly no guarantee how it'll work. The ideal from the legislature, and I think also from the state agency's point of view, would be to know, you know, if there are caps, that the cap's a real cap. That you could say, this is the maximum amount we have to pay out. there's an argument based on the analysis, both the majority analysis and the concurring analysis, that if you lift those caps, if you push them up higher, you may be able to push them up high enough that the court will say, adequate remedy for purposes of constitutional purposes. And we don't care if you have a $17 million claim. What the legislature has provided is enough. And so, no, we're not going to suddenly say the caps are gone. We're going to say you've now provided enough that we're not going to allow people to recover beyond that. If indeed that works, it provides a way to go where you could, in fact, save caps and have them be real. And if you, if depending on the big, huge question is, well, how much? How much do you have to push them up to get to that point? And I don't pretend to know that answer, but Justice Ballmer's concurring opinion makes some suggestions. For one thing, he says, you know, medical malpractice is really different. You know, most of the state's liabilities, we don't run many hospitals. We run one, OHSU. And medical malpractice really is different. And he points out that the average doctor carries insurance of between $1 to $3 million for claims that, I think probably $3 million is more common. You know, I don't know how much they all carry now, but they certainly carry millions of dollars. As opposed to, say, the average homeowner who carries a policy for liability of, you know, $1 to $300,000. And Ballmer's concurring opinion specifically says that the current caps might be fine as an adequate remedy for purposes of things other than medical malpractice. So, for you're talking about the automobile accident, maybe $200,000 is enough on that. So, there's a strong suggestion there that medical malpractice, if you looked at the limits on that and shove those up, that perhaps you could get this back to an adequate remedy. If you do nothing, if you say, let's leave the law the way it is, we will continue to have cases come down because we will have to figure out, you know, each one will raise that question, how much did the jury say I was going to get versus the $200,000? And you will get the case of $10 million, you'll get the case of $1 million, you'll get the case of $400,000, and maybe someday we'll kind of get some feel for this as far as how much, how big the claim has to be before $200,000 isn't adequate. You can, of course, eliminate the caps. That, of course, is the most expensive option. And also, if you have no caps whatsoever, it means literally that the state becomes a tremendous deep pocket for recovery, because at that point, you know, there is no limit on how much the state is going to be able to pay out. That would be a huge problem for local governments, of course, because the state can withstand a $20 million claim. A small city in eastern Oregon cannot stand a $20 million claim. That would be bankruptcy for them in that scenario. And you say, well, do cities actually have medical malpractice claims? Many, many counties have county health things where medical service provided. You can, there are the possibility of those types of claims against counties, etc. So if you just take the cap off, you're going to have that possibility of those large claims and questions about what happens if there simply isn't coverage for them if a county gets sued for those, for that type of money. So the issue, the options as I see it are do nothing, eliminate the caps, raise the caps, and perhaps look at a separate cap for medical malpractice or something along those lines. All of those, you know, those are policy issues about how you go about doing that. I don't think it's really a legal question at that point, but I think those are the types of options you're looking at with respect to where we're at right now after the Clark case. I think that's pretty much what I had to say. I'd be happy to try to respond to questions. It's kind of a complicated area, and I apologize for the confusion in it. Hopefully that gives you kind of the idea of where we're at right now with the decision that's come down.
No, I think it was, I found a very lucid and informative presentation.
Very good.
Yeah.
And I've got two hot senators over here, and yeah. I think the first one is Senator Burdick, followed by Senator Holcomb.
Thank you.
When you suggest a separate cap for malpractice, you mentioned the county health organizations. Would they have to be wrapped into something like that if you had a cap for malpractice?
Chairperson, Chairperson, I'm sorry, Senator, I missed a piece of that.
You mentioned the possibility of raising the caps as a strategy, and mm-hmm. for Senator Walker and I tried to work on that last session and weren't quite able to get it done. But in conjunction with that, you also mentioned perhaps a separate cap for malpractice. Now, if that were the way we went, would the county health departments, in other words, anyone who provides any kind of service, would they be included under such a cap?
Chair Pozanski, Chair McPherson, it depends on what you say in the legislation. If you say this is the cap for all public bodies on medical malpractice claims, yes. The Torts Claim Act right now applies to all public bodies, very broadly defined. It's a huge range of about as broad a definition of public body as you can find. In fact, there's at least one private entity that's in there raising interesting questions about whether you can do that even. But it depends on what you say. If you want to have it applicable to them, you can. But if you don't, if indeed you need to raise the cap in order to establish certainty about, in an attempt to establish certainty, that's all we can say at this point, because again, we don't know necessarily that even raising it does save you from the adequacy argument. Certainly that's the clearest path that we see at this point. But if it does work, I would think that the counties would want to have that as well.
And Mr. Chair, to follow up, if you had, is there any case law to indicate that the remedies clause might affect economic damages and non-economic damages differently in terms of adequacy of remedy?
Chairman McPherson, Senator Burdick, no. But those cases, you know, one of the big things that are difficult for me to wrap my head around is the right to jury trial cases versus the right to a remedy clause. You know, Article 1, Section 10 versus Article 1, Section 16. I'm going to have to work on that in my head a little bit. I've read these cases many times. It's still a difficult thing for me to figure out how they fit together. My conclusion at this point is if you provide an alternative remedy, you're outside of the question of right to jury trial and caps. So if we're talking about an alternative remedy, you get to sue the county in lieu of suing the individual, and you raise the caps. I would think that you could provide different levels for, I mean, right now we've got a $100,000 cap on non-economic damages in the existing law. So you can set that cap. It doesn't have to be $100,000 special, $100,000 general. You can mix and match. The question is, have you provided an adequate remedy?
Thank you.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hendricks, it was a very good presentation. You and I have had long discussions about sovereign immunity and the OTCA, because I think last session you drafted maybe 5 bills for me on this issue. And in 05, I had a couple of bills as well. One thing the court decided here was that OHSU did have sovereign immunity. So that was decided, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. There was one other case that you didn't mention in your discussion today, and that was the Smothers case, and that one addressed the remedy clause as well, and that was another one that came out right when the legislature was still in session in 2001, I believe, because I remember they acted very quickly. The question, I have a couple questions, though. In the workers' comp system, they are able to set limits, like they set limits on whether you lose the use of a foot or an arm or whatever. I mean, it's sort of like the Veterans Administration does that as well. My father-in-law was considered disabled at a certain extent because he lost his leg and he got a certain amount of money. So you can do that. The legislature can certainly do that. And break it up in that manner. So your suggestion that
And that was certainly a suggestion I was looking at, too, making the medical malpractice something separate and apart from the rest of the OTCA. But even within that, you can just, we have the authority as a legislature to really just mix and match, as you said, for any level, as long as it meets the adequate remedy clause, correct? And I think it's going to be case law that's actually going to be determining what the adequate remedy clause is. Is that true?
Chair Pozanski, Chair McPherson, Senator Walker, that's true. The Smothers case, for instance, is a good one to bring up because the Smothers case was a case relating to workers' compensation. And the Smothers case came up because we had amended the workers' compensation law to basically preclude certain people based on a standard that was set for aggravation of injuries, that certain people were basically left without any ability to go through the workers' compensation system to collect for certain aggravation. Because of the standard we set, we changed in the statute. And what the Supreme Court said in the Smothers case was, look, you can come up with this alternative system, workers' comp. You can come up with this alternative system. What you can't do is have individuals who are left without any remedy for their particular claim that they would have had a remedy for, in 1857. So you can adjust these different types of things. Say we're going to provide a higher limit for this. We're going to have a different limit for non-economic damages. What they're going to say, though, is if you have individuals who are left without any remedy, that's not going to fly. You have to have some ability to get at that. Now, none of these changes that I've talked about that I can see would result in that, would result in someone just saying, I have no remedy. And they've also said not everybody has to get the same. They have said that, they look at it as sort of an overall system and say, yeah, there can be winners and losers as long as, you know, everybody gets some remedy, and we can say that overall it's an adequate remedy.
And Mr. Chair, one final question. And Mr. Hendricks, you indicated, and you also indicated in response to Senator Burdick's question, that when you were talking, you said you could, that the state basically becomes a deep pocket if you eliminate the caps. Well, that's true in a sense. There are other states, many states, who don't have caps, and they do quite well. And that leaves it on the jury system to decide. And juries in this state have been relatively stingy in terms of granting large awards that are outside the realm of reasonableness. But when you answered Senator Burdick's question, that you alluded to that, does the jury system take the place of the adequate remedy clause? Does the jury have the right to make the decision whether that's an adequate remedy? I think they do, and then the person can then appeal to the court whether that really was an adequate remedy. Is that your opinion?
Chair Pozanski, Chair McPherson, Senator Walker, the decision on whether it's an adequate remedy will be a question of law that the courts will decide. I mean, that's a constitutional question about whether or not that's statutory structure. So it won't be a jury decision to be made on that. As far as, again, the concern with unstated liability is more, I think, with local governments and what happens there in the event of a very large claim against a small. Because we're talking about every public body, in essence, within the state of Oregon, including little tiny fire districts and things that I'm not sure. You know, these would be very good questions for risk management. And I would think before you take action on this, you might very well want to have someone come over and talk to you about that, because these are insurance questions when you get down to it. In essence, the question is, if you were a small town, would you be able to get a policy for unlimited liability? I don't know. I don't know insurance law that well or the practical reality out there. Would you be able to go out and get an unlimited liability? Most policies have got limits on them. You know, you get a $3 million policy. Most of them, as I understand it, don't have a policy you can get that says we'll pay whatever gets, you know, maybe Lloyd's, I don't know. But it would be good questions for the insurance side of it, because the question would be, would you would it be possible for local governments to address that problem if they had unlimited liability? Or would you want to go to a different standard for local governments versus the state?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Hendricks, for your presentation. And this is in part a follow-up to Senator Walker's question in your discussion. You said that the decision about whether it's an adequate remedy is a question of law. But if I read this correctly, the OHSU admitted that there were damages in excess of the limitation, but they didn't admit to the 12 plus 5, $17 million that was alleged. So what I'm trying to figure out is there going to have to be some sort of two-step process, because what's alleged, there's never been a jury determination of damages in this case, as far as I can tell. And so where does that jury decision get made in this process? Because all they did was admit, yes, the damages are above the limitation, and then the question went up. So if the prayer and the complaint is that what's going to set the test, and if so, is that going to be then sort of hypothetical question?
Chair McPherson, Chair Pozanski, Representative Monamici, that's a very good question, and the reason that it's a good question is it's unclear at this point how these cases are now going to proceed in the future. Mm-hmm. I think that's very clear. I know what will happen in Clark versus OHSU. It will go now back down to trial. Mm-hmm. These amounts were conceded for purposes of the appeal. Mm-hmm. They did not concede them as saying, yes, we agree. So I presume this will be going back down to trial, and then there will be a jury determination on it. The question will be for the next case, and what does the trial judge do with it when someone comes in with a claim for $1 million and they're going, well, the trial judge is going to go, I don't know if this is adequate, you know, the $200,000 is an adequate remedy. They will rule one way or the other. Some of them may let them go on to trial and then let it go up on that. My feeling is they would reserve ruling on that and let it go up all as part of the package at the end to the appellate courts. But there will be a lot of litigation because you will have those cases and there is no clear answer at this point.
And just a follow-up, please.
Okay.
Thank you. Do you have a sense of the, not specifically, but approximately, the percentage of the tort claims against the state involve medical malpractice?
Chairman Kurtz and Chair Pozanski, Representative Bonamici, no. I suspect that's the other thing I think would be a good question for risk management. And the reason I say that, too, I'd be curious to know how many large claims they really have. My understanding is the huge majority of claims they get are within the $200,000 claims. That these claims here tend to be claims that come from places like OHSU, where you have that potential for a much larger claim than you normally do with many of these cases. However, I'd add to that it's quite possible to get a $20 million claim based on an automobile accident as well. I mean, you can put someone in just as bad shape by running a stoplight as you can by medical malpractice.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Hendricks, for being here today and sharing this. To me, this is a broader issue than just the state. We're talking about tort reform here. And I'm just curious, you made a statement there's a private entity that's covered under a public umbrella. Who's that?
Chair Pozanski, Representative McPherson, Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron. There is one entity in there that is private, nonprofit child care entities that get more than 50% of their funding from the state. That came in, I'm not sure when, a long time ago. And it was obviously, back in the 90s, I did many, many bills attempting to bring what appeared to be private entities under the Tort Claim Act, because people were seeking the protection of the caps. And, you know, generally I, even at that point, I think was setting up some red flags about whether you could do that or not. Because the whole premise of the Tort Claim Act is that you have sovereign immunity, but if you were a private entity, you never had sovereign immunity. And I don't know if it did much good for those people as far as their premiums from private companies. The ones that it did do some good for We did bring in some entities that were questionable and put them underneath the insurance, basically insurance coverage of the state through risk management, which basically said, look, you're going to go ahead and get the insurance policy, but we're not sure you're going to get the caps on the damages if you get sued.
Right. I'm not sure I got it. We got the answer. It's a child care provider that gets more than 50% of their funding from the state.
Yeah, private nonprofit child care agency.
Do you know what company that is?
I have no idea what
representative. Mr. Chair, are you sure it's child care? Because is this what we did in 2005? There was a small nonprofit in Washington County that provided transportation for elderly.
Chair McPherson, Chair President Centerburg. Actually, that was another one. This other one has been on the books for a long time. I'd forgotten. I think we did add that one in 2005 for a private nonprofit transportation agency. So
that got more than 50% of the funding from the state.
The theory being, of course, that if you're getting more than 50% of your funding from the state, you're essentially acting as a public agent of the state, and consequently should get the benefit of it. I'm not trying to adjudicate whether or not that works or not here at this point, but
if I may,
go ahead.
Yeah, let me ask you another question. As we're talking about this, we're comparing a little bit to the workers' comp system as being a remedy, so we could limit the amount of payouts. Can't in a workers' comp, if a worker is injured, can they not go back and sue their employer civilly for negligence on top of their workers' comp?
Representative Cameron, the workers' compensation law has a provision that's been in from day one that makes the workers' compensation system the workers' exclusive remedy. They have no ability to go to sue their employer. The Smothers case opened up a gap in that, because the Smothers case said that for these certain employees who were unable to get benefits because of the changes made, they were left without remedy, and they do have the ability to go back to sue their employer.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Yeah, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chase, and thank you very much for allowing me to sit in on this fascinating discussion. I think, Dave, there are numerous complexities raised by this case, and I mean they range everything from whether OHSU is a special animal to, you can see by all the lawyers that filed briefs in this what the state reaction to it is. But I guess my question would be, it seems like this situation is fraught with complexity. And one of the problems with the legislature, because the opinion is saying this is crying out for a legislative solution, I guess one of the problems would be, though, defining the problem that is to be solved here, because it's by no means clear to me, just scanning this, what limits, if any, would be adequate, or what the court thinks are the implications for other entities other than OHSU. So could you take a stab at just saying how complicated do you think this is, or how many groups would need to be involved in what would be an adequate analysis of what this case raises and what needs to be solved?
Chair Kozanski, Chair McPherson, Representative Rosenbaum. It is complex, and it's primarily complex because the decision is one of those decisions that is fact-dependent. It's saying, given these facts, we're telling you this isn't an adequate remedy. And leaving you with the next question, well, what facts coming down the line are going to, or what changes could the legislature make that would lead you to conclude that it's now an adequate remedy? Would it be enough to push it to this level? Would it be enough to push it to this level, et cetera? Would it be enough just to raise medical malpractice as suggested by the concurring opinion? I think the answer, the direct answer to your question is all the legislature could do, assuming they want to make changes at all, is to try and see what the reaction is, make a decision about what they want to do, send it along, and wait for the next case to come along. And then the alternative, if you do nothing, is we will get more cases, because those cases will come along where it isn't 17 million, it's 500,000. And those cases will go up as well, and at that point we may get some clear indication from the court with respect to how much they think the difference has to be to get to that adequate remedy determination. The problem with doing nothing, as I said, is it leaves a lot of insecurity with both for the state and for local governments about how much coverage and what's going to happen in the event of these claims and how to handle these claims. That's going to be the other thing. I mean, I think it's going to be very interesting. If nothing's done, it would be interesting to see what would happen with, you know, most of these claims are settled now. I'm sure that's as true of most insurance claims. Most of them are settled. But if suddenly someone comes in and they've got a $500,000 claim, do they settle, or do they figure it's worth it to go take my shot at it and litigate it and see what happens? And if you've got $1 million, it's even more costly. Or if you've got a $500,000 claim that you think you could make a good argument for $1 million, do you push it up to $1 million because you figure, well, I've got a better chance of collecting that rather than just the $200,000 I'll get if I settle now? So I think there's a lot of dynamics that are going to come into play here. As claims come in, I think it's going to happen no matter whether you act or not, to tell you the truth. But it's clearly with the status quo that is going to happen, I think.
Mr. Chair, if you have a comment, one more. Just so I'm clear on this, Mr. Hendricks, if an employee driving a state car seriously gets in a serious accident, it's their fault, they run a red light, they put somebody in the hospital, and the medical bills of that individual that they put in the hospital are above the $200,000 mark, which is easily done in our society today. Does the state not have to pay that? Is that what we're talking about today? But right, that's correct.
That is correct.
Okay.
The limit on their liability is $200,000 for both special and general debt, both the bills and the pain and suffering. It's $200,000 per claim.
So, I mean, in reality today, a normal person that has any kind of assets or a small business that has any kind of assets is carrying probably $1 million umbrella to cover their auto policies and other things. So what we have here is a self-insured organization, the state of Oregon, that sets their own limits on what they're going to pay out, but yet we have small businesses and our private citizens having to play by a different set of rules. That's correct, right?
Representative Cameron, I think that if when you read the concurring opinion, I mean, they're not making that argument about, but they actually talk about the policies that are coverages that are carried by individuals, both doctors and other homeowners, and look at that to try to determine to some degree what the average person would think is a safe level of insurance. Now, I think that's a little weak argument. They even admit, you know, there's no, that shouldn't determine what's constitutional and what's not, but they say it's something they would, at least that judge, Justice Ballmer, would look at in trying to determine what's adequate. And they point out, they say most people carry more than what the state has now as far as insurance for their claims against them.
Thank you.
Another question. Thank you. Mr. Hendricks, we did have testimony from DAS on April 23rd, 2007, if anyone wants to go listen to the hearing on Senate Bill 280. And we also had testimony from OHSU and also the special districts who are concerned because they have a lot of volunteers. And that's what you were talking about, this broader than OHSU. Let me just ask you, if we were to think about separate liability limits for MedVal cases as opposed to any other kinds of case where the government is sued, there's also some variations that you can have within that. For instance, Dr. Robertson, when he testified, said that, well, you know, OHSU is a teaching hospital. And I actually can tell you exactly what he said. He said, we provide hope to those who don't have it, and the Tort Claims Act allows us to say yes when others say no. And so he played up on that pretty significantly in the committee, but I had to remind him that Jordan Michael Clark was not one of those experimental surgeries. He was not one of those cases where another hospital sent someone to OHSU because they had better expertise. He was a routine heart surgery, a very routine heart surgery. So there, I want people will hear when we're talking about increasing the med mal to take a look at that, because maybe if you want to protect or indemnify OHSU in those kinds of experimental cases. For instance, there was a woman who testified by written testimony saying she was scheduled to die. She would not have lived if she had not done this experimental surgery that OHSU provided. So have her sign a waiver and say, you know, I'm not going to sue OHSU if something goes wrong in this surgery because I'm going to die anyway. So you can have any kind of flexibility within that system, right?
Senator Walker, yes. I mean, you can have a lot of, even within medical mal, of course, OBYGN specialists carry much higher policies than a general practitioner. I mean, you can have variations along those lines. Waivers, I've drafted a lot of bills over the years for waivers of, you know, liability. They're tricky because of informed consent issues, et cetera. Always difficult to be sure. I mean, there's, you don't need a law to have that now, to purport to have a waiver. I have not seen any cases on them. I don't know if doctors just don't do them or what, but you don't see too many of those cases.
You wouldn't have to require a waiver. You could just say in the law that there's a limit to experimental type surgery.
I'm going to step in for a second. We're getting into a lot more detail at this point than where we're going to go today. This is supposed to be an overview. We're already behind, and I know that many of us have other committee assignments. I've got one that's going on in another committee room right now. So, Mr. Hendricks, I want to thank you very much for giving us the overview. Stay tuned. We will be doing a heck of a lot more on this in the coming months. And whether we do anything in 08 is still to be determined. Maybe some quick fixes that we could look at is to kind of give some immediate relief, and we'll be discussing those in the future. So if everyone with your cooperation, I'd like to go ahead and move us into our next and last topic. Mr. Hendricks, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hendricks.
And our last topic today is a revision on ORS 163.305, defining mental incapacity within the sexual offenses statutes. And Heather
Hartigan?
Buchanan. Excuse me. Yes, Mr. Buchanan, thank you very much for being here. And
I'm going to be very short on time. Can I just take 1 minute to plug in?
You bet.
We introduced this one, and we're going to give you all the clues, and we've got a call with the phones.
I schedule all day, but I just sit down this year. And, you know, there's so much stuff to schedule.
Chair McPherson and Chair Krasanski, members of the committee. My name is Heather Hutana, and I'm the Director of Programs for the Oregon Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. And I'm here this morning to share with you that the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force has prioritized amending ORS 163.305, which defines mental incapacitation. While the current definition outlines the condition or state of mental incapacitation, it ends by qualifying that condition by requiring a means by which a victim will become mentally incapacitated. And I just want to point out that in our other sex crime statute definitions, where we have an inability to consent, for example, physical helplessness, mental defect, and even in the case of age, all of those definitions are very focused on the condition or state and don't in any way qualify that by specifying the means by which someone must become or get into that state, if you will. So the membership of the task force has recognized in its work over the last 7 years that there is a very strong tie between the use of alcohol and sexual violence, and in fact that alcohol is used specifically and with purpose to make victims more vulnerable and accessible in order to complete sexual assault. I would add that it is the chief toxicologist Mark LeBeau with the Federal Bureau of Investigation has actually spent the last 10 years traveling around the country, presenting at national conferences, state and local conferences, whether it's for prosecutors, law enforcement, or folks who work directly with victims, to really address this issue of the very striking connection between the use of alcohol, the purposeful use of alcohol, and the facilitation of sexual violence. So very quickly, I realize that you all are on short time. I just want to very quickly go through a little bit of research that Dr. David Lisak conducted in the late 90s. About 1,800 men were given a survey at the University of Boston, Massachusetts. And in that survey, there were a number of questions, but most poignantly, those questions were about their sexual experiences, and outlining or detailing whether or not they had committed any kind of sexual assault or forcible rape or other kinds of person crimes, if you will. At no time did the survey specifically say, have you ever raped someone, but rather questions were worded in a way that it would meet the legal definition. What Dr. Lisak found was that 122 men out of that survey group self-reported to having completed rape. 122. Now, of those 122 men, they committed a total of 386 rapes. In addition to that, they also completed 20 acts of sexual assault against peers, 365 acts of child sexual abuse, 91 acts of child physical abuse, and 264 acts of battery against an intimate partner, or domestic violence, if you will. I make this point because I also want to suggest that when we're looking at the criminal activity of rape and sexual violence, that it's important to remember that we often see other person crimes connections, and that, again, the use of alcohol as a way to create a vulnerability or malleability in a victim is something that could constitute criminal intent, if you will. I also want to note, in terms of this survey, that none of these crimes were ever reported or prosecuted, and I think that that's a really important note, which is the essence of the research was in identifying what Dr. Lisak has termed the undetected rapists. So those rapists who are able to successfully commit sexual violence and go undetected and unreported, and for a whole variety of reasons. I want to also illuminate a couple of the social findings that Dr. Lisak found, namely that the assailants were purposefully using planning and forethought in order to create vulnerability in individuals, and in addition to that, that alcohol was specifically noted as the way in which victims were rendered more vulnerable. And there are additional social findings in there that you all can review. What I'd like to do is close with one of the actual narrative transcripts between Dr. Lisak And one of the individuals who was among the 122 who self-reported committing rape, and he outlines the way in which he committed a rape. Now, I think it's important to note before we watch the video that this isn't the kind of disclosure that you would get in a law enforcement interview. This is a disclosure that you're getting when he knows he has protection and anonymity from any sort of legal recourse. So with that, let me see if I can get us the right place.
This is a pre-law student.
Pre.
We had parties every weekend. That's what my fraternity was known for. And we'd invite a bunch of girls, lay out a bunch of kegs or whatever we were drinking that night, and everyone would just get plastered. And we'd all invite girls, all of us in the fraternity. You know, we'd be on the lookout for the good-looking girls, especially the freshmen, who were the young ones. They were the easiest. It's like they didn't know the ropes, kind of, you know, like they were easy prey. And they wouldn't know anything about drinking or how much alcohol they could handle. So, you know, they wouldn't know anything about techniques.
What were those techniques?
Well, we invite them to the party, you know, make it seem like it was a real honor. Yeah. Like we didn't just invite any girl, which I guess in a way is true. You know, and then we'd get them drinking right away. We'd have all those kegs, but we always had some kind of punch also, you know, like our own home brew. And we'd make it with a real sweet juice and just pour in all kinds of alcohol. And it was really powerful stuff. The girls wouldn't know it hit them. They'd be guzzling it, you know, because they were freshman, kind of nervous, and it was just juice anyhow, right? So,
when you say it was just juice, you mean the girls wouldn't know that it was spiked with alcohol?
Well, they knew. I mean, they knew that. At least the smart ones did. But it was a party, right? Not some kind of, you know, like social tea. I think they must have known, or most of them did anyway. The ones that didn't had to have been really naive.
Well, did you count on them being naive?
Yeah, the real young ones, the naive ones were the easiest, and they'd be the ones that we'd target.
What do you mean by target?
That's what we'd call them. You know, we'd all be scouting for targets during the week. You know, we'd pick them out, work them over during the week, and then get them all psyched up to come to one of our famous parties. They'd be the ones we'd really work on.
What would happen once they were drunk at the party?
Well, that's when one of us would make our move. You know, by then each one of the girls had been kind of staked out by one of us, meaning one of the guys would be working on them, getting them drinks, you know, keeping the juices flowing, so to speak. And you kind of had to know your moment, you know, when to make the move. You basically had to have an instinct for it.
Can you describe what happened in the specific occasion you referred to in your questionnaire?
Yeah, sure. I had this girl staked out. I picked her out in one of my classes, you know, I worked on her. She was all prepped. I was watching for her, you know, and the minute she walked into the door of the party, I was on her. And she was really good looking, too. And we started drinking together, and I could tell she was nervous. I could tell she was nervous because, you know, she was drinking that stuff so fast.
What was she drinking?
Well, this was some kind of punch we'd made, you know, the usual thing.
Did she know it was spiked with alcohol?
I don't really know, although she must have after a while, you know, because she started to get plastered in just a few minutes, and, you know, so I started making my moves on her. I kind of leaned in close, you know, got my arm around her, and then at the right moment I kissed her, you know, moved in a little closer. You know, like the usual kind of stuff. I'm sure it was no surprise to her. She'd done it 1,000 times before, you know, and after a while, I asked her if she wanted to go up to my room, you know, get away from the noise, and she came right away, so... Actually, it wasn't my room. You know, we always had several rooms designated before the party, you know, that were all prepped for this.
Designated rooms?
Yeah, we'd set aside a few rooms, you know, bring the girls up to once they were ready.
What happened when you got to the designated room?
Well, she was really woozy by this time, so I brought up another drink, you know, and sat her down on one of the beds, sat down next to her, and pretty soon I just made my move. I don't remember exactly what I did first. I probably, you know, leaned her down on the bed, started working on her clothes, filling her up.
How did she respond?
I don't remember. I started working on a blouse off, you know. I think she might have said something. I don't remember. I didn't expect her to get into it right away.
Did she say anything?
Yeah, at some point she started saying things like, you know, I don't want to do this right away or something like that. I just kept working on her clothes, you know, and she started squirming, but that actually helped because her blouse came off easier. And I kind of leaned on her, you know, kept feeling her up, get her more into it. And she tried to push me off, so I pushed her back down.
Were you angry?
No, but, you know, it pissed me off that she played along the whole way and then decided to squirm out of it like that at the end. I mean, she was so classy, she probably didn't know what was going on anyway. I don't know. Maybe that's why she started pushing on me, but Yeah, I just kept leaning on her, pulling off her clothes. And at some point, she stopped squirming. I don't know, maybe she passed out. Her eyes were closed. What happened? I fucked her.
Did you have to lean on her, hold her down when you did it?
Yeah, I had my arm across her chest like this, you know. That's how I did it.
Was she squirming?
Yeah, she was squirming, but not as much anymore.
What happened afterwards?
I got dressed and went back to the party.
What did she do?
She left.
You know, there are many...
That concludes my video presentation. I think in summary, I would just like to say that it is certainly the hope of the task force that this is a legislative concept that can be moved forward during the 2009 legislative session, and that we've already begun to work with supportive partners like the Oregon District Attorneys Association, the Oregon Advocacy Center, and the Legislative Alliance on Violence Against Women. In addition to that, we are beginning to actively engage in outreach with other stakeholders who would have an interest in how this definition is crafted and the issues that surround it. And for example, we have engaged in some conversation with representatives of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and feel very confident that we'll be able to reach some kind of consensus that would be both equitable for defendants as well as victims of crimes such as the one that was just outlined.
Before we take questions, let me just make a statement. As put forth in the paperwork that we received, this is a concept for 2009. We will be working this issue and have more discussions as we go through the interim process. So I'm going to just give that caveat just because of knowing of the time. We have some time for a few questions, but let's not get bogged down, because this is an issue that will be worked on after the supplemental session.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I just want to understand in context the goal of this proposal. It's my understanding that currently the definition of mentally incapacitated comes up in determining the capacity to give consent primarily. And just so that I understand, sort of in plain language, right now there has to be proof that the alcohol or the substance was consumed without the consent of the victim. And you're just saying, okay, if the victim gets drunk intentionally without the alcohol being snuck into the drink, that should still mean incapacitated for purposes of the prosecution. Is that
Chair McPherson, Chair Prozanski, Representative Bonamici? That's absolutely correct. That what we're really looking at here is that if the condition is the issue, if someone is unable to grant consent, then that's specific to the condition or the state, and really has nothing to do with how someone comes to be in that position. And an example that I might provide to you in an analogous situation would be physical helplessness. That if someone is physically unable to communicate a lack of consent, whether they came to be that way of their own accord, for example, they committed a DUI driving accident and became physically helpless, that we don't actually use the means by which someone becomes physically helpless. We just look at the condition. And so, again, we're looking at if someone is unable to grant consent, they're mentally incapacitated, that should be the focus of the statute.
And just a brief follow-up comment, I completely support that. I don't think it should matter whether the victim consumed the alcohol intentionally or it was snuck in, but I don't think, as appalling as that person was in that film, I don't think that particularly helped make this point, because he made a big point of trying to explain how he snuck the alcohol to her by making it fruit juicy and everything. So I think that supports the existing statute, that he did actually, she didn't know how much she was drinking. I think your point is that it shouldn't matter. So, just a comment.
Any further questions? Then hearing none, I think you're able to conclude this part of the program. Thank you, Ms. Hutanen. We appreciate that presentation. It's very provocative. Okay, that you need to take action in a...
I think the Senate has concluded its work today as to what we're going to be doing during this hearing. Work session has been completed. I do want to remind the senators that we will be having a hearing this Friday, 9 a.m., is scheduled for those who can be here in Salem in Hearing Room E. It will be for the purpose of introduction of Legislative Concept 47 and LC 48. And for those who are listening, they will be able to participate as they are now. And I know that some of the members will not be able to be in person because this is a very short scheduled meeting in the sense of last minute because of
Very good. Well, that concludes the work of the House Interim Judiciary Committee and the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. So I will close the January 16 meeting of the House Judiciary Committee.
And I also close the Interim Committee, Senate Judiciary Committee for January 16th, and we'll look forward to hearing or seeing individuals for the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee this coming Monday. Thank you.